You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Welcome to the Cycling Podcast. Joining me, Graham Wilgos, recording on the day that Britain's Charlie Tanfield goes for the UCI hour record at the Velodrome in Konya, Turkey. And making sure we stay on the optimal racing line is Lionel Burney, and giving us the inside track on dinosaurs, Danish cycling, and far beyond is the Baron himself, Brian Nygaard. Gents, how are we both doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you. I'm seeing the both of you. I can tell the both of you are doing absolutely fine from the looks of it.
I'm just wondering, Brian, what it's like to be in the centre of an international cycling media storm after your comments about Jonas Vingegaard in last week's podcast. They've gone viral. You've been reported as the oracle on all things Jonas Vingegaard, haven't you?
Yeah, much to my surprise, I would say, Lana, much to my surprise. Because I've been trying throughout the course of the tour, 3 weeks, every single day, a rather significant, lengthy piece in the paper, which is my job, twice in the 9 o'clock news or morning news on Danish TV, radio, live every day. And then all it took was a single rant or analysis on the cycling podcast, and it all exploded in front of me. And Italy took it up in the Tutu Pici web, which is our, I would say, our friends and neighbors during the Giro, Daniel and ours especially. And there was a lot, as often happens when these things go viral, bits go missing, don't they, and change over the course of translation or get lost in translation. So there is a bit of a corrections corner here, if you don't mind. And they call it, the podcast is being renamed The Cycling, and it's also changed ownerships in the course of a week to being mine. And I don't think that's really fair. So I'd like to hand over the keys again to the Cycling Podcast to you. And it also
didn't like the attention, handing back
and
the keys.
Interestingly
had it for
enough,
a week.
I do believe I mentioned him being a carpenter. Yeah, and in the Italian version, he became a plumber. And nothing against plumbers, though. I would personally rather be a carpenter myself than being a plumber. And I actually thought that building a kitchen, which I've actually done or had done at home where I'm sitting now, I thought the plumbing bit was the more tedious part than the carpentry.
I thought your comments last week about Vingegaard were very measured and reasonable. Maybe it is a thing of being lost in translation, but I think it also a bit of an insight into the goldfish bowl of Danish sport that Jonas Vingegaard is in as well. You know, I think we sometimes lose sight of the fact that in a country where you know, he's such a focal point for the entire sport, every utterance about him and his performance and, you know, his potential future performance gets analysed and micro-analysed. But I think it's more to do with that rather than the global influence and significance of the Cycling Podcast, which, of course, is immense.
It is. Well, as much as anyone would entertain doubts about that, me certainly not. It's certainly being listened to, right? So the traction is there, Lionel. That's not to be debated.
A spike in listenership in Denmark over the past week, certainly.
Well, just to end this on a high note, I've been dubbed character assassination as early as this morning.
Wow, that's strong.
It is strong.
And what was the dinosaur link? Who was accusing who of being a dinosaur?
I always try to defend myself by going harder than anyone who's going after me. And former bike rider Brian Holm on his podcast, which I don't know, remember the name of, and I call it Jurassic Park because, you know, him being of the former a couple of generations ago. He said, and he said that before, actually, so I think he means it, that if you are not a former bike rider yourself, as he was in the past century, you shouldn't pass judgment on other bike riders. And my editor on the...
Well, we're
screwed, right, basically. So the thing is, and my editor actually called me up this morning, and that's quite interesting. And she wanted me actually to write a piece about it for the paper, which is one of my other jobs. Because she also said that's interesting, because then the ballet critic at the paper also needs to be sort of reconsidered, because that person has not been a ballet dancer herself. So basically it means that all these functions of being critics or analyzing certain areas, you can't really be a voice of opinion if you haven't participated in it actively yourself. So that's a whole other discussion.
It is. We'd be on sticky ground there, unless, of course, sort of third cat racing counts.
I mean, it still counts as racing, but that's the
extent of my experience.
I see a bike. I see a bike behind you. I also see a football shirt, Lionel. So I mean, you can. There's multidisciplinary issues here.
I think we should dampen down the flames of controversy here before anyone gets issued with a yellow card. We certainly don't mean any disrespect to our friend Brian Homer, who's been an insightful voice on the podcast in his old role as a sports director at the Tour de France and other big races. But yeah, I just thought it was interesting how this would all flare up, and perhaps it's the we'll perhaps have a different impression of Jonas Vingegaard when he dominates and dismantles everybody at the Vuelta a España in a couple of weeks' time.
As I mentioned also, can I just say that for the record?
Excellent. Well, we shall see. Maybe we'll play in next week with the Jurassic Park theme tune as a tribute. The Vuelta actually begins next week, so it might be a month's time that we play in with that particular theme tune. Shall we move it on, chaps, and round off a bit of the racing that we've seen in the past week or so since last we were together, since last we recorded. Lionel, let's start with the Tour of Poland and a very... comfortable win in the end for UAE's Brandon McNulty, taking the GC there, thanks largely to his performance in the final stage time trial. Small victory to pick out the increasingly impressive Matthew Brennan for Visma Lisa bike. Anything else catch your eye at the Tour of Poland?
Well, it was Brandon McNulty's overall victory, which kind of completes and continues rather the UAE Team Emirates domination of the World Tour this season. I mean, the numbers are worth spelling out here because they have won 9 of 12 stage races in the World Tour so far this season. Jonathan Narvaez won the Tour Down Under. Tadej Pogacar has won, of course, the UAE Tour, the Dauphiné and the Tour de France. Juan Ayuso won Tirreno Adriatico, and João Almeida won Itzulia, the Tour of Romandy and the Tour de Suisse. And now Brandon McNulty adding the Tour of Poland. I mean, to add to that, they've also won 5 of 16 of the one-day races as well. But it really is in the stage races that UAE Team Emirates have everything dialed in. And Brandon McNulty kind of stayed just where he needed to be all week and then got the job done in the time trial, didn't he? It was stage 6 that really set him up because he was the only rider to go with Ineos Grenadiers' Victor Langelotti, who won the stage. At stage 6, McNulty finished just on his shoulder, and then it was going to come down to the final time trial. And I think from the intermediate check, it was fairly clear that McNulty was going to win overall. And he won the final stage and beat Antonio Tiberi overall by 29 seconds. Langelotti slipped to 5th place on the final stage. But as you say, Graham, Matthew Brennan is putting together a very impressive season, isn't he? Yeah, every time he races, he delivers a big result. And this is another World Tour stage win after a couple at Catalunya back in March and a stage win at the Tour of Romandy as well. You know, a sprinkling of other wins at the next level down. But he is an impressive young rider, isn't he? And maybe we'll talk about him a little bit more when we discuss Ineos and their future plans, because this is a young, talented British rider who has completely evaded Ineos Grenadiers and is delivering results already at the age of 20. Well, he's only just 20. His birthday was last week, and he's doing the business for Visma Lisa Bike.
Yeah, cleaned up at the Tour of Norway too. We'll get to the Arctic race of Norway a little bit later on. Before we do, Brian, you've been keeping an eye, just to jump around a little in terms of timeline, but you've been keeping an eye on the Tour of Denmark, and we're back from the Baltics, yeah, two stages in.
It's actually been quite entertaining. It was really busy start to the race. Could potentially be an early decider. Mads Pedersen and Mathias Gelmoser took control of the first stage quite early on. The one on the island of Bornholm, which is actually, I forgot to say that last week, is the birthplace of and where Magnus Kort grew up. This island of Bornholm, far away in the Baltic Sea, just off the coast of Poland, closer, a little bit closer to Russia than the Danes are.
You can get to it quite easily from Copenhagen, sort of, though, I read.
Ferry trip. But it's quite typical of Mads Pedersen when he's in shape. He attacked relatively early on the most difficult part of the day, broke away, joined up to a group that was in a breakaway, and then he took care of business in the sprint. Do you know that, speaking of taking care of business, do you know who also had that as initials, who also looks a lot like Mads Pedersen? Elvis Presley. Have you noticed how much he actually looks like Mads Pedersen?
He hasn't got the same quiff, though, has he? Are we talking about a later years Elvis Presley or an early years Elvis Presley?
He actually had a TCB on the back end of his private jet, as short for taking care of business, TCB. Anyways, Mads Pedersen took care of business on the first stage, got into the lead. Yesterday on the stage to Gladsaxe, which also is the headquarter of Novo Nordic, which is the biggest company of Denmark, Skelmose crashed in the local laps. He was okay, but he lost time. Mads Pedersen is still in the lead. Today there's a time trial in Kerteminde, another small island in Denmark of Funen, and I suspect Mads Pedersen will consolidate his lead. There is, however, still the big Queen stage, which is quite a hard stage for Denmark in Tuvalu, very long stage, 200 kilometers plus, where it's actually a stage where I was commentating it on site a few years ago, where Remco Evenepoel basically rode away from everyone with, I don't know, half the stage left, sort of a lap where they go over a 20% climb quite a few times. So there's still a bit of racing left, but I would be surprised if Mads Pedersen doesn't have this one already in the bag.
Well, talking of races that we thought a particular rider would have in the bag, Isaac Del Toro and the Vuelta Burgos, Lionel, I think you said last week that you'd be amazed if he didn't come through and take the overall there. And true to form, it was another one for UAE, as we've just said.
Well, yes, but I did think that he would win that final stage, and actually Giulio Ciccone beat him. And I think that indicates that Ciccone is on course for the podium at the Vuelta a España. It's looking good, isn't it? Better late than never. But no.
They're playing the long game with Ciccone, right, aren't you?
I think he'll be okay. But no, Del Toro, an impressive overall victory for him. And as you say, another one for UAE Team Emirates. But Ciccone looked good on that final stage. I mean, you know, a kind of welter style finish, because it was the lakes, Lagos de Nyla, wasn't it? The other thing that really stood out was Leo Bisio of Decathlon. Everyone's been talking about their sensational young 18-year-old Paul Seksas, who will be riding the Tour de l'Avenir very shortly. I think that starts fairly soon. But Leo Bisio is another talented young Frenchman on the Decathlon Agir d'Azur. Yeah, and Bisio held the lead until that final stage to Lagunas de Nyla. And a good week's development for him. He's only 20 years old as well. So Decathlon Agir d'Azur, with their influx of money and sponsorship and backing that's going to enable them to take a step forward next year, they've already got some young riders sort of queuing up to take advantage. They've sort of got their ducks in a row a bit. So I think we might see a fair bit from Bisio well, later on this season and next. He is going to make his Grand Tour debut at the Vuelta, according to the provisional start list. So he'll be a rider to watch, I think. He finished third overall in Burgos.
And one more while we're here, the Tour de l'An, which I think you've been keeping an eye on as well.
Yeah, a lot of racing to watch. And I was glad for the tip-off from Brian about the opening stages of the Tour of Denmark, because they were a visual feast, weren't they? Lovely countryside, very, very rural, you know, but pretty. And yeah, thanks for the tip there. The Tour de l'An in a more familiar part of Europe for me anyway, over there in, well, the sort of foothills of the Alps, really, isn't it? And it was another good couple of days for Nicolas Prodhomme, because he won stage two just ahead of Kian Utgebrugs of Visma Lisa Bike. And then the final stage, Utgebrugs won, well, he turned the tables on Prodhomme in fairly sensational fashion, because he won by more than 3 minutes and won the race overall. His first victories as a professional rider, a young Belgian rider who's been talked about a lot since turning pro, initially for Bora Hansgrohe, but then a bit of a fractious transfer to Visma Lisa Bike, wasn't it? But he is starting to show the potential that we've all known he has got. So quite a significant win that for Utgebrugs, because, you know, his talent has been obvious for a number of years. Yeah, he had that transfer from Bora Hansgrohe, as I said. And last year he started both the Giro and Vuelta and didn't finish either of them. This year he's having a season without a Grand Tour on his schedule. And I think that's a case of a Visma Lisa Bike not only prioritising Jonas Vingegaard's overall bid for the Vuelta, but also a bit of a softly approach with Utgebrugs, and you know, taking a step back, if you like, in order to take some steps forward in the next year or so. Still only 22 years old. He was up there in the mix at San Sebastian a couple of weeks ago, finished ninth. And I think there's something about a young rider, particularly a climber, getting that first win, it, you know, can sometimes propel them on and really add to the sort of level of confidence, because riders like him, the opportunities to win can sometimes be few and far between, and because he needs sort of outright climbing stages.
I think there's so much substance in him, and I think the even if it's not the biggest scene that he won on, I to me that could be a real turning point. And a top 10 in San Sebastian is as significant as anything, I would say, at this point. And when you look at the racing that remains to be seen in this season, there should, when we, you know, with the Italian classics that are basically all about climbing in September and October, there should be plenty of possibilities for him to really show his mettle.
And at a time when I think certainly you and I, Lionel, are both guilty of having said it either this week or last, when we say there's not much going on, there's actually, and I think Brian, you pointed it out last week, there is loads going on, but it's all kind of, you know, because we've been spoiled with the Tour de France and the Dauphiné before that, it's an easy trap to fall into. But there is tons going on at this point in the season between the Tour and the Vuelta.
Yes, there is. It's just there's that lack of a focal point in these few weeks, isn't there? This is kind of the height of the summer, and the cycling season goes into a sort of holding pattern, doesn't it? We're waiting for the Vuelta to start, and then we have the World Championships, and then the sort of end of season races. But you know, the Tour de France happens, and then there's a bit of a kind of a lull, and it feels like it's quite hard to get a handle on what's going on. We should just do the results of the Arctic Race of Norway. As I say, we will hear in the third part from Sophie Smith, Australian journalist, very experienced journalist. She was there in the north of Norway covering the race. It was won overall by Corbin Strong, ahead of Tom Pidcock, who won the Queen stage, if we can put it that way, the uphill finish. And there were a couple of Norwegian stage winners as well. Alexander Kristoff rolling back the years with another win. And Fredrik Diversnes of Uno X Mobility, the Norwegian team, of course, winning on the final day. But we'll hear from Sophie's adventures in the north of Norway in the final part of the podcast.
Dominant from Corbin Strong as well. Two second place finishes and a stage win, as well as the points jersey and the young riders jersey. But yeah, looking forward enormously to hearing about Sophie's experience out there. It's a race that I would really love to go and cover and go and sort of, you know, take in on the road. Elsewhere, chaps, we've seen plenty of transfers at a time when plenty of transfers confirmed anyway, at a time when there is not much going on. And I'm thinking in particular of Serdal Quickstep, who continue to reshape their squad in the wake of Remco Evenepoel's confirmed exit. So this week they've confirmed Dylan van Baarle from Visma Lisa Bike and Alberto Dainese from Tudor Pro Cycling. They are looking like they're shaping up to be a very serious contender for the classics. Not that they ever weren't, but that's certainly their focus, or it would seem to be their focus for next season and beyond.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because as you mentioned, historically, it's been their identity more than anything, and Evenepoel, for better or for worse, was the odd guy out. There was sort of a transitional, could be or could not be, with Alaphilippe, because he, in that year when he held on to the yellow jersey for such a long time, I remember having a bet going with Rolf Sørensen whether he could actually finish on the podium or not. Mental reminder that he needs to pony up that dinner for losing. But the thing is that he was always sort of he was too good to really be a GC rider on that team, wasn't he? Because it didn't really work out bolstering the team for him. But the interesting thing is now it's clearly relieved up some budget to build up a new team for the classics. But it's also it's a difficult path to go down now, because without Vanderpool, without Pogacar, maybe even Van Aert. I think after what we've seen this year, we shouldn't write him off. I think that would be disrespectful. You could only potentially go optimistically for the podium. And when you see that, you know, when you keep reminding yourself that it's a Belgian team with the Belgian press, even without Kurtowicz writing the analysis, anything less than a victory is also a failure in the classics when you're a Belgian team. Just look at Lotto when they were trying to compete with Quickstep back in the days. So it's not an easy one, is it? You know, and as much of a classy rider Dylan van Baarle is, it's been a while since he won Roubaix for Ineos, hasn't it?
What was that, 2022 off the top of my head? Lionel Kevin Vermaak, the young American, or youngish, 24 years old, has gone to Team UAE, or UAE Team Emirates, I should say. They continue to build quite an impressive sort of support squad among their superstar roster. Can we see anyone leaving UAE in order to sort of pursue opportunities elsewhere?
Well, not as things stand, because both Juan Ayuso and João Almeida are contracted to next year. Ayuso is beyond next year. I do wonder how things will look after the Vuelta, without sort of getting into the kitchen sink drama, as I described it, and without overly hoping for some internal shenanigans between those two. There is a real jostling for position behind Pogacar, isn't there? And Pogacar kind of making his noises about counting down to retirement. I know, slightly tongue-in-cheek, but he has said a couple of things in interviews about, you know, counting down the years. I mean, he's still only 26. But UAE Team Emirates have got, a formidable roster of riders. Almeida is actually older than Pogacar. It's easy to kind of forget that because of the Pogacar's results. But then, Ayuso is only 22, Del Toro is only 21, and they've signed another young Spaniard, only 19 years old, Adrià Pericaz, who was, I think, in the top 10 of the Giro Next Gen, as it's now called, the baby Giro, as we used to call it. And there's a lot of excitement about his likely potential, and he's another rider who signed a long-term deal. I think it will be a case of riders, realizing that opportunities are limited at a certain point and looking for the exit door rather than UAE Team Emirates seeking to move anybody on. But, you know, they're stockpiling talent, aren't they? And this is something that we're seeing across this small handful of teams. In the next part, when we discuss Ineos Grenadiers, you know, you look at UAE Team Emirates, Visma Lisabike to an extent, a slightly lesser extent, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe with what they're trying to do. You know, Ineos Grenadiers have been kind of left behind a little bit in terms of planning for the future and picking out riders who may well deliver in, you know, 2-3 years' time.
Yeah, we'll come on to that. But Ineos, at the moment, they feel a bit like West Ham do in the transfer window this summer. Haven't really made a move for anyone. You're not really sure what next season's going to look like, and you fear for them a little bit.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN, the virtual private network to keep you safe and secure whenever you're online. Now, we're all online a lot of the time these days, aren't we, with our computers, phones, tablets, even smart TVs connected up to the internet. And you want to be sure that those connections are secure. And NordVPN will give you that peace of mind. The most important things to protect are your private data, of course, things like bank details, passwords, and online identity. But NordVPN will also protect you from viruses, malicious malware, and phishing sites. I think it's best to be safe than sorry. So a NordVPN subscription will give you an extra layer of protection whenever you're online, either at home or on the move. To get the best discount off a NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/TCP. That link will also give you 4 extra months for free on top of a 2-year plan. There's no risk either because Nord offer a 30-day money-back guarantee. There's a link to nordvpn/TCP in the episode show notes. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP and try it risk-free today.
So, gents, Team Ineos, lots to say about them. Lionel, you and I talked about them a lot over the Tour de France. I mean, since the start of the tour in Lille, you know, the story with the allegations from Team Sky's past, with Dave Brailsford's return, those allegations sort of seem to stalk him for all, you know, the rest of the tour, and it concerns their head carer, a Slovenian called David Rosman, who had been involved in Operation Adalas doping investigation dispatches relating to alleged text messages between him and Dr. Mark Schmidt. Schmidt was subsequently jailed after that investigation for doping offences, and that was shortly before the 2012 tour. Now, fast forward to Dave Brailsford and Team Ineos in the past few weeks saying that they would not be commenting on the allegations, but they did subsequently confirm that Rosman had been contacted by the International Testing Agency and was, well, he left the tour, didn't he? So we understand he was at the tour and very, very quietly left the team hotel around about halfway through. So that brings us to today, and as we understand it, on transfers, all transfers for Team Ineos have been halted for the time being while Dave Brailsford takes charge, and it's yet to be seen where they go from here.
Yeah, we should give credit to Daniel Benson for this because he wrote about this in his Substack, which is a great read if anyone wants to keep up with, especially transfer news. But the suggestion is that some of the deals that Ineos had in the works have been put on pause by Dave Brailsford, who's going to take a much more hands-on role with recruitment going forward. Just on the situation with the head carer, I made a kilometre zero about that, Graham, at the Tour de France, which people can go back and listen to. It's called Never Go Back? And it concerns Dave Brailsford's return and the way that some of the ghosts of the Team Sky past and some of the allegations and cases concerning the team are sort of rattling about a bit like skeletons that have been disturbed, really, by Dave Brailsford's return to the team. And I think there's definitely a sense through the Tour de France that the the team has lost its way. It's a long, long way from even the team that the Ineos organization inherited sort of in 2019. Remember, they won the Tour de France that year. In fact, first and second, weren't they, with Egan Bernal winning the Tour ahead of Geraint Thomas. And since then, it's just been a kind of steady, consistent journey in one direction, which is kind of downwards. And when I started making that kilometer zero, the initial idea was going to be to sort of analyze their team, their kind of future objectives, and how they could get back to challenging the teams that have very definitely overtaken them in the last three, four, 5 years. Obviously UAE Team Emirates, Visma Lisa Bike, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe being three of them. They're a country mile away from challenging for a Grand Tour. And of course, the whole founding principle of the Sky team as they were in 2010 was to win the Tour de France with a British rider, which of course they did initially with Bradley Wiggins and then with Chris Froome and then with Geraint Thomas. And now it's a team that, you know, it's internationalized, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. It doesn't necessarily have to have a British core. It doesn't need to be a British team if that's not what they want to be. But with the kind of loss of a sort of British core of riders and that British identity, it hasn't really replaced that with anything else. When you look at the roster this year, 6 of the 29 riders are British. That's the lowest number of riders the team has ever had from the country that it is registered in. And like I say, that doesn't necessarily matter, but they haven't really replaced that with a kind of a beating heart of any other kind. Carlos Rodriguez is a very talented GC rider, but he's a kind of, you know, podium bet at best, really. And Daniel Benson had a line in his Substack, which I agreed with, which is that Dave Brailsford is not going to want to stand outside the Ineos Grenadiers bus at next year's Tour de France, kind of welcoming Carlos Rodriguez home in fifth place overall every day. That's just not in his DNA. They will want to rebuild and identify a way to challenge at the Tour de France again. But the difficulty, as we all know, is without one of those top two riders, it's going to be very difficult for them. So they need to re-establish a kind of a purpose, a sense of what that DNA is. And I don't necessarily see an easy way to do that, but it will start with some kind of purposeful recruitment now, rather than just filling the roster with guys. I mean, I rather disparagingly off the mic described Ineos Grenadiers as a team that, time and Aaronsman aside, were just guys riding around France. And that is not what Dave Brailsford or John Allard or the Ineos organisation will want to repeat. So they need to really go in next year with a much clearer idea of what it is they're trying to be.
But with whom? Can I just, in all of this speculation, also when you were at the Tour or anything sort of being spoken around the buses, were they actually in the mix of trying to sign Evenepoel, or was it even discussed?
I think it had been. When I spoke to John Allard right at the start of the race, he kind of said in a slightly exasperated way, you know, oh, everyone says just go and sign Evenepoel, but it's not as easy as that, which is what he said. And my sense was that they were already out of the race by that point. And of course, that was around about the time that the rumours of Evenepoel going to Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe had started to break. It would have made sense, I guess. Ineos, probably one of the few teams that would have kind of a gap in the roster, but also the budget to sign Evenepoel.
I think it would make a lot more sense for Evenepoel when you look at what's on the team already compared to where he's going.
Very possibly.
To be the one sort of standout GC star in that squad, yeah, as opposed to one of two, possibly three,
I think
as he is now.
I think it's the question. I think it's because of Specialized that he didn't go. I can't see any other reason. I don't think it's money, and I don't think it's the perspective of his possibilities to become a better rider, or his, you know, how he would be able to win or be a competitor, a real competitor at the Tour. I think the options are easily as good at Ineos as they would be at Bora, if not better. I think it's because of Specialized.
Well, I think you're probably right there, Brian, because there was also a lot of talk about Pinarello's contract with Ineos Grenadiers coming to an end and potentially not being renewed, and what bikes will the team be on next year. They've not commented on that, but you know, there are rumours that, you know, they might be looking around now for an alternative bike supplier. You would think that would be sorted by now behind the scenes, but definitely I think the Specialized link with Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe was the one that made the most sense and probably was the thing that ruled out Ineos Grenadiers. But it does leave them in this curious situation where, you know, they have apparently signed Kevin Vauclin, but then there's a few other transfers that are on hold, one of which being Filippo Zanna. They've also been linked, according to Daniel Benson, with Benoit Cosnefroy. I mean, these are not the sort of marquee signings that the team would need to, you know, really kind of propel itself back to being even one of the top five teams at the Tour de France, which, time and Arensman stage wins aside, they really didn't show a lot of evidence of. I know Carlos Rodriguez crashed out and he may well have finished in the lower reaches of the top 10. But again, that's kind of just participation prize, really, for a team of Ineos's budget and legacy. So they're in a real tricky situation here. I was looking on the side of the bus, and again, this is perhaps a little bit unkind to do, but they list all the names of all of the riders on the current roster. And I was struggling to find more than sort of six or seven that you would definitely keep from the 2025 roster. If you ignore the younger riders, like, you know, there's no reason to jettison riders who are 19, 20, 21, who haven't really got going yet. But there's an awful lot of riders who are ripe to be moved on, either because of age or because they just haven't delivered anything over the last few years. And then what you're really left with is hoping that Egan Bernal can recover his previous heights. Filippo Ganna, of course, you know, he is an outsider for classic races. You know, we talk every year about him getting a little bit closer to winning a cobbled classic, for example. A very, very classy bike rider. But then after that, Axel Laurence, yes. Carlos Rodriguez, I guess by default. Magnus Sheffield kind of falls into the halfway house between the youngsters that you would definitely keep and being keepable just through his results. Josh Tarling is a talent. Ben Turner, you know, won a stage of the Tour of Poland and is definitely a kind of is a sort of totemic figure within the team when he races. But other than that, there's an awful lot of riders that they need to move on. I mean, Castroviejo will be retiring, but Laurence de Plus, Tobias Foss, Omar Fraile, Bob Jungels, there are riders here that have kind of passed their sell-by date on Ineos's watch. And it reminds me of the great football manager, Bob Paisley, who said that the biggest danger in football management is when you let a good player's legs basically go from you while he's in your squad. You need to move them on before their time is up. And my sense looking at the roster is that Ineos haven't been ruthless enough at getting rid of people, and they haven't been sharp enough and smart enough to recruit young riders. We can talk about the new generation of Great Britain riders who have come along without really Ineos Grenadiers having a sniff of signing them. And they are currently delivering results for other teams. And it might be that they have to go and spend some money and buy somebody out of a contract here or there just to give the team some kind of, you know, jumpstart the engine a little bit. A bit like when they came along, Brian, and you'll remember this very well, that first roster in 2010 was missing something fundamental at its very heart, wasn't it? And that rider was Bradley Wiggins, who had just finished fourth at the Tour de France for the Garmin team. And they had to spend quite a lot of money to get him out of that contract. And it was a bit cantankerous and there was a bit of bad blood about the transfer. But it gave Team Sky a unifying figure, an identity and a sense of purpose, which Ineos Grenadiers currently just don't have.
Yeah, exactly. It had identity and it had a narrative, and that's those are the two things certainly missing now. That they have all, you know, the only identity almost left is the look of the team, the current look at least, right? And they just they drifted out of relevance. They drifted out of what made them stood out. You know, before they went from, you know, having the era of Wiggins, the era of Froome, Geraint Thomas. Even Geraint Thomas, when he didn't produce results, was still a name, a figure, so like a point of interest. But without him, and also even the randomness of
Bernal's crash has done so much damage to their relevance in the peloton, which is something that you always can happen. Imagine if Pogacar crashed and had a similar accident with UAE. Okay, that they would still win bike races, significant ones, but it would also do a lot of damage. And the same thing would be if Vingegaard crashed out for Jumbo. But this, the thing is now with the team is that they there's just this lack of unifying relevance. And, you know, after when they entered the scene, Team Sky, they brought something I thought back then, and I think a lot of other teams looked to with jealousy, which wasn't just the budget, but also the willingness to take on board sports science, to take on challenging dogma, challenging, you know, back when sports directors were also coaches, back when sports directors were doing, for lack of a better word, sports science, but it was just old habits that were perpetuated into how riders were doing everything in their lives. And it was 20, 30-year-old nonsense to a certain degree. And Sky really challenged that. But now it's a starting point even for teams in the top 10, top 15. And all of that is not a proprietary IP for Sky anymore. It's common sense now at the World Tour level. So they've lost that as well. And after Brailsford left, his aura, for better or for worse, also disappeared. And now when it came back, it only really brought back the negative parts that he didn't deal with when he left in the first place. And the fact that he didn't tackle that head on has sort of left a gap that he can't go and reclaim his authoritative relevance as a leader before sort of taking that on and giving substantial answers. I think he would have been better off tackling that situation because, I mean, to be fair, right, had they had any dodgy issues with that Soigneur in case, I don't think they would have brought him to the tour, right? They were like, oh, hey, we have this guy, there could be something about him. You know what? Let's just bring him to the tour anyways. Come on. Seriously, I don't think that would be the case. That's an oversight and a stupid one at that, but I really don't think they would have brought a Dutch Soigneur to the tour in front of the entire media, cycling media of the world. That's just my take. So I think dealing with that could have been done a lot more intelligently. I think the problem with them now is that they have so much catching up to do, and they lack a clear purpose because they're just, like you mentioned, Lionel, they're just a bunch of guys riding around. They just they don't win enough. They don't have a solid enough. They don't have those 30, 40 wins. When you look at, we spoke about UAE winning so many stage races. When you look at the material they have at Ineos, they have a lot of good time trialists. And that's a good starting point for winning a week-long stage race, right? Because if there's usually like, say, 20 or so, 10 to 17 kilometer time trial, they have a bunch of riders who can do that. The problem is if you only want to win on the World Tour, if you only want to win those big races, maybe it could be an idea to send someone like Ghana to the Tour of Denmark or someone like Watson to some of those races just to pick up those substantial wins. To be fair, they're still number 6 or 7 in the rankings. They just don't stand out anymore. They don't scare anyone anymore. And that, I think, is it's a shame, certainly for them. It's probably the point that I'm trying to make.
Brian, to your point as well, that the questions that overshadowed Team Ineos' Tour de France and the fact that they haven't been dealt with by Dave Brailsford. I spoke to a rider from that first successful Team Sky era earlier this week, and he was of exactly the same mind that Dave Brailsford has to address. It has to be him who addresses these questions before they can start to move on as a team. And when you read, you know, on Daniel Benson's Substack this week, when you read that the Felipe Zana mooted transfer has been put on hold, and he's even to the point where he's gone, or his representatives have gone back to Team Jayco Alula and said, oh, actually, do you want him back? And can we kind of smooth this over? It all speaks to the same thing, which is they are in this remarkably, well, it's just a remarkable holding pattern that until these questions are addressed and until riders possibly feel like that, like Tymon Arensman was left to front up at his press conference after that, after his first stage win at the Tour in Super Bannière. If it's riders who are going to be asked these questions and they're kind of this constant shadow over the team, then it's just impossible for them to move on. And they're also far less of an attractive proposition for the top riders that they supposedly want to attract.
But the problem is also it mirrors in too many ways how they took or didn't take care of the Landers case or the Jiffy Bag case. It's the lack of confronting it substantially in the first place and putting it to rest as to the best of your abilities, I suppose, but not taking care of it in the instance where it's brought up, and things are brought up quite heavily at the Tour de France. I mean, that can't be a surprise to anyone. You get what you in communication terms is called a double crisis. You get a crisis based on how poorly you manage a crisis. And that kind of sticks, you know. You tend to sort of, it tends to grow out of the level of crisis that it actually is because of poor crisis management, which is stupid because you let it grow further than it actually needs to be.
Especially when they announced in the third week that actually they'd commissioned an external law firm to investigate back in April. So somebody knew that this was rumbling on in the background. It just seemed to be sort of porous management, really, like everything was slipping through the cracks. And I think I got a sense of that this year at the Tour de France, that, you know, Dave Brailsford's come back. Let's be honest about it. He has not been a success at Manchester United. You know, whatever he's done in the Ineos Sport organization to this point, you know, he was in a very high profile role at one of the biggest sports organizations in the world, and the sense, maybe this is unfair, but the sense is very much so that he has been moved to the side to go and kind of rescue the cycling team, which is also bumping along the bottom a little bit. But it's not like he's doing that off the back of a triumphant spell at Manchester United, where all of the problems there have been solved and the club is back on track. So it feels a bit like he's been marginalised, pushed to the side a bit. And just the external kind of look at how the team operates. I mean, Brian, you'll remember this. Team Sky, back in the day and throughout their era of dominance, they set the bar very high on almost all levels, on and off the bike. You know, how often were they the first team bus into the paddock at the Tour de France stages? Very, very often. And we used to kind of joke about it. The bus would win the GC race every day, get into the start early. And you think, well, why does that matter? Well, it doesn't really. It gives the riders a little bit less far to travel through the crowds of VIPs and people to get to the sign-on podium and so forth. It means that the team bus is first in the convoy to get the best spot at the finish. You know, these things are those small marginal things that can just add up to make the day a little bit smoother for the riders. In and of themselves, it doesn't matter if you're first bus in or 10th bus in, but 2, 3, 4 times during the Tour, I noticed, especially the day in the Massif Central, the Ineos Grenadiers bus was last in, to the extent on that day that they weren't even in the fenced off compound. They were kind of the barriers had to be moved so they could get the last bus into the available space. And it was just one of those little emblematic signs of a team that is just not on its toes.
Well, a couple of things on that, guys. I mean, it's obviously down to him to change that then, and make. I mean, he sets the tone, the schedule, and any standard that he walks past is one that he accepts, and all that stuff. When he was at New York Times have covered this quite at length, also, you know, in their sister publication, The Athletic, because of the ownership of Ineos, they've had huge financial issues. The entire, you know, sports franchise has had to save money. They've given up certain sponsorships, and Manchester United have been asked to save an immense amount of money, and they've been going through all their budgets, and millions of pounds have been had to cut off. And the same has apparently happened on Ineos Grenadiers, the cycling team. And I've heard from people working there that it has also been the case there, and they've had to cut down on serious places.
And oftentimes when that happens on teams mid-season, you know, when you already have a budget that's been in place and you already have a level of expenditure for certain things, and then you stop winning bike races with a certain frequency and you start going through staff expenses, you start cutting down on certain things. It could be small things, right? It could be meals on a rest day. It could be a glass of wine when you win a bike race. It could be, you know, the atmosphere just also starts to collapse a little bit. And it's always been a very serious team, but it's also in those times that when you start not winning, when you start not producing success, that if that's then also the same time that you also start to be critical on the budget and you start to cut down potentially also on renewals, on salary, on expenses, on all those things, it can also be a negative spiral. It's a really hard thing to manage. I mean, I heard from Manchester United that staff, you know, the meals in the canteen were, you know, things were cut down, you know, and it's a difficult thing, you know, when you work for the wealthiest men in the UK or in Britain, that then you'd also still have to basically cut away everything else around that's apparently unnecessary.
Well, what sort of atmosphere does that create as well?
A bad one, Graham. I mean, I remember this was, I mean, this is a faraway example, but it does show a little bit the difference on atmosphere and teams. And this was the one and only Grand Tour I did with Team Sky, and that was the Giro in 2010, which was a bit of a disaster through and through, apart from the Wiggins winning the prologue in Amsterdam. But we were finishing up in Verona, and there was not really anyone wanting to stay on much for the dinner afterwards. There wasn't a party arranged, so there wasn't. I could sort of sense everyone was trying to get out of there as fast as possible. And I said to Brailsford back then, there hadn't been any alcohol, not a beer, wine throughout the entire 3 weeks for the staff, and everyone was quite tired, quite sort of more relieved than anything that the Grand Tour was over. The staff had been worked quite hard, I would say harder than average from what I've seen in the past years working for teams. And I said to Dave, I think it would be a good idea that the staff could have a drink now that the Giro is over. And he said, yeah, order a bottle of wine. And I was like, well, there's 50.
He knows your taste, Brian. You know, he's keeping an eye on the budget.
there was 50 of us, Lionel, including the riders. There was that's a lot of I don't know how to make one bottle last 50 glasses. I haven't even seen that with scientific sort of measurements. And then I was bless his soul, you remember the late Andy Rees? He was in the same hotel as us, and they were in the same dining room as us. And I remember he was walking from wherever he was coming with the bottles, and I think he had 5 bottles in each of his big Swiss hands, going to each table, 10 bottles for the riders' table and 10 bottles for the staff table. And I said, that's the difference, Dave, between a happy team and a team where people just want to go home. And it's quite important that you realize that sometimes you actually have to let go a little bit.
There was a lot of resetting at the end of 2010, though, wasn't there? And Team Sky, they made their money count, undoubtedly, in that era. I think the fundamental difference between Team Sky and the Ineos Grenadiers organization is that Brailsford was the top of the chain in Team Sky. Yes, there were the execs at the media company above them that he did have to report to, but he was sitting at the very top table. He had a stake in the business of the cycling team, and so he could make decisions, yes or no. I don't get the sense that that is the case with Ineos Grenadiers. I think there's too many layers above the cycling team. It takes too long to get things approved. It takes too long to get things approved. And they've been caught napping a bit over the last couple of years when it's come to renewing riders or signing new riders. And so that would be the first thing to change, really, to reduce those links in the chain and have somebody making decisions quickly enough.
It's a problem. Geraint Thomas, a problem, Lionel, because they have a huge salary budget. I don't think there's anyone underpaid on the team from a rider perspective, which I think probably, you know, 80% of the budget goes to salaries. But when you think of the talent they've lost, they missed out on for the same amount of money, I think you're absolutely right on that point that they've been napping in substantial periods where they could have signed major British talent. I mean, I'm not saying that they should. I mean, Brennan probably made up his mind to go elsewhere, but that's a really good example.
Yeah, before we talk about the ones that got away, I mean, Geraint Thomas is very strongly rumoured and almost certain to take a sort of managerial role next season. The mooted title is head of racing. I wonder whether that will help to kind of reinstate some of the old ethos. I mean, Geraint Thomas is he feels like a very easygoing type of person. He's very candid. You know, when he talks to the media after races and in his podcast, you know, he talks very freely. He feels like somebody that people get behind, you know, very popular member of the team, you know, not just, you know, we're talking about a team that he's been in for 15 years and, you know, he's been popular with an awful lot of people, both on and off the bike in the organization. I wonder whether that will help to sort of kickstart and just drag the team back to some of the things that made it successful. We gather that Zach Dempster is going to move on to Red Bull, so that's somebody moving out of the sports director role. They lost Steve Cummings at the end of last year, or rather Steve Cummings, you know, left the team at the end of last year, so they've got a bit of rebuilding to do on the sort of sports direction side of things as well, but maybe this will be the catalyst. I did see Rod Ellingworth, who's been working with Bahrain Victorious for the last 18 months or so. He was in conversation with John Allott a lot at the Tour de France. It seemed every time I saw Rod when he was there, he was having a chat with John Allott. That would, to me as an outsider, that would make sense as well, because Rod Ellingworth is somebody who is really big on everyone, riders and staff, taking a sort of sense of personal responsibility in what they do and how they operate, and you know, taking responsibility is something that very few of the riders in the Tour de France manage to do, again time and arrangement aside. But again, when we analyse the performance of the Tour de France, Arensman is a very talented GC rider who, because he'd lost a lot of time, found himself in a position where he could make his talents count winning stages. I do remember Dave Brailsford gave the impression, you know, back in the day when they had the yellow jersey locked down, either, well, with Chris Froome or whoever it was, they viewed these kind of soft mountain stage wins, riders who perhaps should be up in the top 10, sort of winning mountain stages because they've lost a lot of time overall. He kind of gave the impression that they were sort of soft wins. So again, not the way that the team wants to be operating. But I do wonder whether Geraint Thomas will help to provide the catalyst for a bit of an uptick.
I wonder if he's too laid back though. And I wonder if, you know, I'm not sure that you can be both a... you can be part of the management structure at a team like Ineos and be as candid as he has been able to be on his podcast. I think being able to lead by example, as he does on the bike or has done on the bike, is very different to being a DS and sort of needing that kind of attitude to inspire people. Maybe I'm wrong, but
I disagree. I think he is fully ready to be very hard. I think there's a lot. He has a lot riding on this. You know, he.
Yeah.
I agree that there's definitely two types of riders. There are riders who initially are worried that they're too close because they're basically DSing former colleagues, especially in the first couple of years. I definitely think that Geraint Thomas has it in him to be a tough guy when he needs to be, because he has the ability to beat on himself. Especially when you look at his results and when you look at his ability to come back from injury, stuff like that, I there's a huge potential of being a right bastard in him, I think.
But before they do any of that, they've got to address these questions that have overshadowed them since the tour. And it's okay to sort of continue continue the Elvis theme. They can't go on together with Suspicious Minds, Brian.
There you go.
Wow. Wow.
Could have done Return to Sender as well with Zanna, but that's to be seen.
Oh, with the jiffy bag.
No, not the jiffy bag, with Zanna's transfer. if he was mooted to go, and then his representatives are talking about him going back Alula.
It's all about
Jayco
taking
Alula.
Care of business.
Okay.
Just lastly, before we move on, because we're not going to solve the problems for Ineos Grenadiers here, but you just want to mention this sort of generation of young British riders who have slipped through the net. I mean, the most obvious one at the moment, of course, is Oscar Onley, who's just, you know, a hair's breadth away from finishing on the podium at the Tour de France, but he's committed to Picnic Post NL for another couple of years. Picnic Post NL also have Max Poole, who is continuing on that same sort of path of development, but perhaps not in quite as spectacular a way, but very sort of quietly, really. Matt Winston, who people will recognise from his co-commentary on the TNT cycling coverage, you know, very insightful co-commentary it is too. And every time you talk to him, I'm impressed by just a sort of calm, level-headed, medium and long-term focus, which is clearly there whilst they also focus on the here and now. And they've managed to get that balance right for a team with a smaller budget. And they have, you know, they've quietly kind of picked up several young British riders from under the noses of Ineos Grenadiers. Of course, Tom Pidcock, you know, no going back for Tom Pidcock, I wouldn't have thought, certainly not at the moment. He is at Q36.5 after a slightly acrimonious departure, really, from Ineos Grenadiers. It wasn't all plain sailing, was it? But, you know, Matthew Brennan, who we've mentioned, he's tied up at Visma Elisabike for a couple of years. But then there's Joe Blackmore, Israel Premier Tech, Ben Tulit, also at Visma. One rider who's out of contract, I gather, at the end of this year is Fred Wright. And as somebody who would kind of give a bit of a heartbeat to the team, I think Fred Wright, you could put him in a Tour de France team that was going for other objectives and he would find a way to be of real value. If I was in charge of recruitment, I'd certainly look at that. But yeah, it's going to be a steady building process, and they don't have Dave Brailsford doesn't have the benefit that he had 15 years ago, which was that he was 15 years younger. He was at the beginning of a journey that he'd never set out on before. I wonder whether in his early 60s he's got the energy and the enthusiasm. I'm sure he feels he has, but has he truly to really drill down into all of those details need to be unpicked and reconstructed? A very, very hard thing to try and repeat success when you've been at the very, very top.
But the fundamental difference between what he's tried to do with Nice and now Man United as part of that sort of wider Ineos structure is, and a Nice insider said this, he doesn't know football. And we know that he does know cycling, however long he stepped away from it. A quote that stood out from the beginning of the summer from the iPaper, Nice insider said at the beginning, Dave came in one day a week to observe, and then soon enough, he wanted to control everything. Which I think is what we're seeing again at Team Ineos. But as I say, he knows cycling. And if the insider at Nice is to be believed, he doesn't know football.
Yeah, but there are differences here. When he came into cycling 15 years ago, the cycling that he was up against was so old-fashioned that he was actually able to, you know... I would sometimes get frustrated with him, and good discussions came out of it because him and Shane Sutton, they came, well, more so Dave, actually, but they came from the track, which was such in a controlled environment, and they would walk, you know, 500 meters from the hotel to the track, and small differences could be applied almost one-to-one. Whereas road cycling, there's a legio of contingencies that where you can't apply changes one-to-one because other contingencies will apply themselves when you do that. But he insisted, and he was certainly right about a lot of them, because other teams were in the Middle Ages. So you could make a lot of changes because other teams made none and were relying on old dogma. But now there's almost a level playing field in the top 8, 9, 10 teams with sports science, with all those things. So you don't have those advantages anymore. And from the budget point of view, they're not the wealthiest team anymore. They're teams that now don't even have a budget. If they need money, they will go and ask for it, and they might or might not get it. So it's a different type of cycling now. So he actually
he has to reinvent himself now more than anything, I think, to actually make a change. He can't just go back and rely on marginal gains or Moneyball it's a real interesting time in Dave Brailsford's career, because he actually has to go further back than he was before to make a substantial change in the team that he's now back at the realm of, in the reins of, in my opinion.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode is also sponsored by Babbel, an app which has revolutionized language learning, transforming the way that people learn a second or even third language into an enjoyable and engaging experience. Now, maybe you're off on holiday soon, or perhaps you're looking a bit further ahead to next year and you want to go to one of the three grand tours, the Giro, the Tour or the Vuelta, and you'd like to start learning Italian, French or Spanish to make the most of your trip. Because let's face it, when you can understand even just a little bit of the language and you can get by in hotels, bars and restaurants and take in a bit more of what's going on around you, read signs, read the menu, it all adds to your enjoyment of being in another country. And Babbel can help you get started on your language learning journey today, because Babbel will, right from the very start, help you to develop understanding of the language, put into places the essential vocabulary and phrases, making it the perfect travel companion. The key thing about Babbel is that the lessons are flexible. You can dedicate as much or as little time to it. The key being, little and often will help you to build on everything that you learn as you go along. And right from the start, you're learning real life conversation and phrases that will be helpful to you in real world situations. Not everyone is as blessed with languages as Daniel Freiber or Rob Hatch or even Brian, who speaks a couple of languages, Italian being one of them. But Babbel can help set you off on that journey. And right now, Babbel is offering all of our listeners up to 60% off a subscription. Go to babbel.com/TCP to claim your discount. That's babbel.com/TCP to get up to 60% off. This offer is valid for a limited time only. Babbel, language learning that works.
So, gents, we came in at the top of this episode with Charlie Tanfield, Britain's track cyclist Charlie Tanfield, going for the hour record. He hasn't made it. He fell short even of the British record, which is still held by Dan Bigham, 55.5 kilometres an hour and change. So no joy there. But the British Cycling setup have had at least one world record today, which was paracyclist Will Bjergfelt, who went for the C5 hour record first thing this morning, set in 2014 by Italy's Andrea Tarlau. He absolutely smashed it at 46 years old, negative splits all the way, and he's the first paracyclist to crack the 50-kilometre mark. So congrats to him. Lionel, what else might we have missed this week in our sort of any other business section?
Well, I just wanted to give a mention to the Richard Moore Youth Race Series, which has been running all summer with monthly rounds at the cycle circuit, the West Lothian cycle circuit in Linlithgow, which is not far from Edinburgh. And they had the fifth and final round on Tuesday night. And I'm going to just give a name check to the overall series winners. They were the Youth A female category was won by Lucy Sweeney of Edinburgh Road Club. The Youth A Open category was won by Andrew Levinson of Edinburgh Road Club. The Youth B Females winner was Boo Williams of Clydesdale Colts. And the Youth B Open winner was Gregor McNaught of Falkirk Junior Bike Club. And the Youth C Girls winner, Lucy Dixon, also of Falkirk Junior Bike Club. And the Youth C Boys winner, Alastair Ogg of Johnston Jets. Congratulations to all of the winners, but also to everyone who pinned on a number and raced in the Richard Moore Youth Race Series, of course, named in honour of our friend and co-founder here at the Cycling Podcast, Richard Moore, who passed away in 2022. And we are delighted, everyone here at the Cycling Podcast, delighted to be able to support the series. They also had a Buffalo Award for the most aggressive, most attacking, most courageous and committed riders. I will detail all of the winners in a future edition of the 1101 Cappuccino, and we'll try and catch up with how the series unfolded and went in the off season, we'll make something for the podcast about the series, and we very much hope that it will continue next year. Certainly the Cycling Podcast will be supporting it again next year. So thank you to everybody who organized and ran the races as well, because there's a huge team of people from a number of clubs across that part of Scotland who gave up their time and committed all of their energy and expertise to putting on the races as well. So a big thank you to everyone. And I gather it was a fantastic night of racing on Tuesday in glorious summer sunshine in the early evening up there. I was very sad not to be able to make it, but next year I really hope to get to one of the rounds. So well done everybody up there in Scotland, and thank you for putting on the series.
Which only leaves me to say thank you, or should I say thank you very much to you both. A little less conversation from us, Lionel and Brian, and a little more Sophie Smith.
Well, Sophie, you made the long trip to the Arctic Race of Norway, and it's a race I've always wanted to go to. It looks fantastic on TV. What was it like to actually be there?
It was incredible to be there. I think it took me traveling from Australia. I was there for, it took me as long to fly there and get back as I was there for, but the journey was definitely worth it. I've never been to a place where you've just been immersed in so much wild nature before. Outside of the bike racing, it was, you know, one of those places where the majesty of Mother Nature is, you can't ignore it. It's sort of what was for me like almost as big a draw to go and see this race for the landscape and the scenery and being, you know, within the Arctic Circle was sort of one of the privileges of covering this as much as, you know, interviewing the athletes that took part in the four stages.
What's the atmosphere and the vibe like among the riders on the race? I mean, does it feel like a bit of a summer holiday race, or is it, you know, a mix of riders who perhaps haven't done the Tour de France and maybe are building up towards the end of the season? What does it feel like? Is it a kind of a party race with, you know, so much daylight, no one goes to bed?
That was a party race for me on the last day. That's a different story. No, vibe within the peloton, it's a bit mixed, because it's like an early season race in that you don't have the team buses. You're sort of in vans, and everyone's sort of centralized. You're sort of staying in maybe the same hotel for a couple of nights or traveling. But so in that regard, it's quite relaxed. And in terms of the vibe within the peloton, it's mixed, because you've got some people that were there, like Eddie Dunbar, who was making his return to racing after abandoning the Tour de France following a crash. You've got Tom Pidcock, who was there, who's preparing for the Vuelta. You had someone like a winner, Corbin Strong, who was specifically sort of targeting that race while looking forward to the one-day races in Canada. And then, of course, like a stronghold of Norwegian teams that were very proud to be competing on their home roads. That's one thing that really strikes you about Northern Norway, or North Norway as it was referred to, is when you go to these sort of idyllic little villages that are sort of set in this, you know, mighty sort of mountain landscapes where you've got wildflowers growing on roofs and snow-capped mountains sort of coming out from the sea. There's no church spires or anything like that. Everyone sort of seems to integrate with the seasons, whether that's a midnight sun or polar nights, and the outside of the inn, and there's Norwegian flags everywhere. You get the sense that they're very nationalistic or proud of where they come from. So it was a big race for the Norwegian teams that were there. And when it came to, there was one KOM on stage three, which Tom Pidcock won. It was basically, the stage was straight out of the start in Husøy, which is this, I probably don't quote me on the pronunciation of that, but this place was fascinating. It's this sort of tiny little pebble island in the middle of these huge snow-capped mountains that just come straight out of the sea. And, you know, there's, as the slopes go down, I assume in winter it's covered in snow, but in the summer it just looks like something out of, you know, the Shire from Lord of the Rings. Everything's covered in ferns and greenery and purple wildflowers. But the KOM, the prize for the KOM, the first KOM of the day was 100 kilos of salmon. So, and that was a running theme throughout the race because obviously if there were two things you were guaranteed to see on a menu, it was salmon and reindeer. So Corbin Strong, when he won the first stage, he won 50 kilos of salmon as well as taking line honours and setting himself up for the race title. But no, this KOM on stage three, the first one was 100 kilos of salmon. And I became, I don't know why, really invested as to what happens when you win the salmon, like whether they realistically, if you live abroad, ship out 100 kilos of salmon to you. So they present a massive box at the podium, which is just a sample of what you win. But no, it was the Norwegian riders that went for the 100K prize. And UNOX Mobility, the team of Alexander Kristoff, they sort of blocked the road to ensure that happened as well.
So the Norwegians make sure that they win all the salmon. That's fantastic.
Well, yeah, they didn't win all of it, but they won the big one, 100 kilos worth. And there's one of the sponsors whose names I can't remember now, but that they farm and catch salmon from there as well. So it's very fresh.
So I'm assuming you arrived in Norway at Oslo Airport. How remote does it feel traveling north? Because it's still quite a long way to get to where the race actually takes place, isn't it?
Yeah, it was about, look, my total flight time there was 30 hours. So it all sort of started to wash into one for me. But I went Melbourne, Doha, Doha, Oslo, Oslo, Harstad, where the race started. And I think from Oslo to Harstad, it would have been about 2 hours. Like, put it this way, I think Norway's quite long. Like, I had a colleague that works for the Dutch Telegraph, and he flew direct from Amsterdam to Harstad, and his journey was shorter than mine from Oslo to Harstad, if that puts it into context. And Harstad's you get to this very small airport, but the towns we saw all along the way were very different to anywhere else I've been in Europe. You know, like, people speak to you in Norwegian before they speak to you in English, whereas if I'm at the tour and I walk into a cafe or a bar, most, 9 times out of 10, I'm able to speak to you in English. And, you know, they were friendly, but there was sort of a definitive line of, yeah, you know, we'll be friendly, but we're not going to sit here and chat with you either. But the nature, there was one hotel we stayed at that was a little older, but again, built into the side of a mountain, and you woke up to, well, it's the midnight sun. They have midnight sun there, their summer. So at 2 or 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. in the morning, it's still light outside. It sort of doesn't sort of get below dusk at any point in the summer. And then I was told they have their polar nights in the winter from about Christmas till March, where it's darkness 24/7. So
wow,
I lost my sleep mask on like the second day. So I think regrettably, like, a lot of the places we stayed at, sort of, you know, everything's sort of natural light and there's windows everywhere, so the outside's always in, and you know, vice versa. So I did have to regrettably like shut my blinds, and they were just standard curtains, and I had an eye mask over the top, but it's so beautiful outside that you almost, I didn't want to do it, but I had to get some sleep.
What about the race itself? Because it was won by Corbin Strong. Tom Pidcock won the uphill finish stage, didn't he? He's warming up for the Vuelta a España. But what was the sense of the racing? Did it feel, you know, really competitive? What kind of vibe did you get from the actual racing itself?
The stages were interesting. So the stage three, the mountaintop finish or the summit finish that Tom Pidcock won, I think the general consensus had been perhaps on that day that one of the climbers, whether it was him or Christian Scaroni who were there, would win the GC with that stage. But Corbin Strong actually played a bit of a blinder in that, and I'm not particularly familiar with him. I wasn't particularly familiar with him before this race, but after stage two, you know, he either won every stage of the four stage race or came second. And after the second stage, he sort of, Alexander Kristoff won. He wasn't in the mix because he'd avoided a crash and a bit of masterful bike handling, actually. And he'd sort of spoken to the international journalists that were there and said, oh, no, I think tomorrow's going to be too hard. You know, I don't compare to what he called world-class climbers, referring to the likes of Pidcock. You know, I'll fight for the jersey, but probably not my day. And as it turns out, at the finish of this stage, which was bookended with a Category 1 climb at 100, you know, the 100 kilos of salmon prize, and then was sort of flat until the Category 1 at the end. And Pidcock actually sort of whipped that it was a bit boring because apart from those two climbs, there was sort of not a lot to do on the in-between. But that's sort of probably where the script got ripped up, because Corbin Strong was able to stay with Tom Pidcock on that climb, and Pidcock sort of ended up just keeping him on the line. And I had Corbin Strong down in my book more as a sprinter than a puncher, and that's sort of how he sold himself at the beginning of the race. And it turned out after stage three, he actually revealed that that was tactical, and he'd sort of purposely played down his climbing ability on that sort of finish. And I guess you had a long time to recover in between those two mountains as well. And Pidcock had reflected that he was a bit isolated in the finish there as well. And also, though, had he known that Corbin Strong was that good of climbing, that his team had played a little bit different there.
Corbin went off your wheel. What did you think when he was in the back of you?
Yeah, I was very surprised, actually. He did a super strong climb. I think if I'd known a bit, it's always a bit difficult, you know. First time testing the legs in a long training block, but if I'd known differently, I would have gone earlier, try and make the difference and make a gap. But I think he did a super good job.
You know, Corbin Strong said the best man won that stage, and that was Tom Pidcock, and that was probably true. But the way that Strong rode, and he put it down to camaraderie with his team and the benefiting from taking a long mid-season break after the Giro d'Italia this year, and as he's looking to like target Plouay and one of the one-day races in Canada. So there was a bit of, you know, race craft involved there as well. I thought from him that was a smart play, you know, to downplay your chances enough that the climbers in the race weren't looking at him, and he managed to, you know, tow Tom Pidcock to the line.
Yeah, I mean, he was second to Mads Pedersen on the hilly stage at the start of the Giro in Albania, got over the big climb well, and then had a fast finish. And then in July, while we were all still kind of recovering from the Tour de France, the Tour de Wallonie in Belgium, he won the GC there after winning the opening stage. So he's putting together a good resumption to racing there with two back-to-back GC victories in Wallonie in Belgium and in the north of Norway. What was your sense about like why the race exists? Because I've always kind of wondered about this. Is it purely a promotional tool to attract people, sort of throw open the window so people can see the beauty of northern Norway? Because there's already a Tour of Norway, isn't there? But this race, which is a partnership with ASO, the Tour de France organisers, it's been organised and run since 2013. So it's building a bit of a history. You know, it's been around a little while now, but do you get a sense of, you know, what the purpose of the race is, if you like?
Yeah, this was the 12th edition, and I actually wasn't aware of that. I wasn't aware that the race had such a long history. I went in thinking that it's overseen by ASO, and like some of the events that they run at the beginning and the end of the season, there is an element, for example, some of the races in the Middle East, or, you know, the end of season Singapore criterium and Saitama criterium, there is traditionally an element where those kind of races are promotional. But I think this one, Torhushov, was very front and center. And he did speak to some journalists about putting Norway forward as a destination for a Tour de France Grand Depart in the near future. Not North Norway, because you are, I don't know, when we finished in Tromso, which was sort of like coming back to a bit like the Tour de France when you arrived back in Paris at the Tour de France, it was a bit like coming back to civilization after being in just beautiful nature for a couple of days. It was sort of almost had you in a deeply meditative state. But there's a suggestion there from Hushov that Norway may perhaps push towards hosting a Grand Depart, or at least putting a hand up for that before 2030, as I understand. And there is also a tourism element to it. You know, it's a serious bike race in some ways. You've got a mixed peloton there. Obviously, you know, no one's from the tour, or apart from maybe like Eddie Dunbar off the top of my head was there, but the people that are there are sort of using it a bit as a barometer or a training race, dare I say, for the future objectives. For someone like Corbin Strong, who's targeting one day races, and a puncher, the momentum you get from your second title victory in as many months, I assume, is quite good, and maybe not as difficult for someone like Tom Pidcock to sort of gauge his form, but also claiming a stage win and having a bit of a hit out after a long break is beneficial too.
Well, people can read about your adventures in Norway, Sophie, on your Substack. It's called Spokes, and people will find that by Googling it or going onto Substack and searching Sophie Smith Spokes. A couple of really entertaining diary pieces you wrote from your travels in Norway, Sophie, and maybe we'll all be back there for the Grand Depart of the Tour de France at some point in the future. I don't know, perhaps Oslo will host the start of the tour, and maybe that would be where they would be thinking of kicking off the Tour de France if Norway were to make a bid. But thank you very much for joining me today, Sophie. It's been great to hear about your adventures up there in the north of Norway.
Thank you so much.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.